House members consider their next move after the Senate adjournment from the special session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after more than seven decades, a bridge in the Mat-Su Valley will be shut down for vehicles.
Because the bridge, the steel is corroded and rusted so much, it's virtually impossible to salvage it and to restore it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Members of the State House Republican-led caucus are deciding their next step after the Senate abruptly adjourned from the special session yesterday. After a closed-door meeting of the caucus this morning, House Speaker Mike Chenault told reporters that he planned to talk with Senate President Gary Stevens and see if anything comes from that before a decision is made. He said the House will have a floor session as scheduled Monday morning. Under the state constitution, the House could remain in special session, forcing the Senate to return every 3 days. Stevens indicated yesterday that this would be a fruitless endeavor, noting the House has no bills before it, and he didn't see a way forward in the Senate for the only bill left on the call, an in-state gas line that Chenault says is necessary. In a further step, the House Resources Committee this afternoon scheduled a hearing on Monday for an undesignated bill dealing with an in-state gas pipeline. Chenault indicated earlier this week that he was working on further changes to the gas line bill the House passed last month. That legislation, HB 9, is a priority for Chenault. He and other supporters say inaction on it will delay progress on an in-state gas line. For the second time, Alaska's voting district map is headed to the state Supreme Court. A week ago, a Superior Court judge rejected the state redistricting board's amended version of the map, but earlier this week, the board decided to appeal the lower court decision. Supreme Court oral arguments have been set for the week of May 21st, only 2 weeks before the June 1st candidate filing deadline. Although the board will ask the court to approve its amended plan, board attorneys have drafted a petition asking the High Court to authorize use of an earlier redistricting plan for this year's elections. The justices allowed for that option in March when they sent the first plan back to the board for additional work. Due to safety issues, the Eklutna Bridge on the Old Glen Highway will be closed to all traffic in mid-May. The municipality of Anchorage plans to make corrections on the bridge so that bicycle and foot traffic can begin in early June. John Smith is a public works project manager for the municipality. Smith says the bridge has been a source of concern for some time.
We did take a look at trying to rehab the existing steel structure, and it just became cost prohibitive. Because the bridge, the steel is corroded and rusted so much, it's virtually impossible to salvage it and to restore it.
The bridge closure will not affect nearby communities, which can use the new Glen Highway. Smith says the span across the Eklutna River has been in service some 77 years. A 2010 bridge inspection by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities has shown progressive weakening of the bridge's structural members and welded connections.
The load rating has steadily been decreased, and now it's at a point where people are being cautious about, you know, the size of vehicles that go over it, and so that's why it's being closed.
Smith says a new bridge will be built at an estimated cost of $14 million. The Forest Service has tentatively approved a major timber harvest plan for Kuprinoff Island near Petersburg. The Tonka project would allow a substantial amount of logging in an area of the Tongass Forest that's seen a lot of it in the past. The agency emphasizes economic benefits from the sale, but opponents say the cost is too high. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Tonga's supervisor Forrest Cole's decision calls for the sale of 38.5 million board feet of timber from nearly 2,100 acres of land. That's a big project, more than the average annual cut from the entire Tongass in recent years. Considering the many issues involved, Petersburg District Ranger Jason Anderson says the plan provides the greatest opportunity for an economically viable timber sale. The agency projects that the project will support 154 to 183 jobs. According to Anderson, that estimate includes all the harvest, milling, and support sectors that might benefit.
From start to finish, you're basically your mobilization of the equipment out there, your harvesters, your cutters who are actually going to go out and fell the timber, your loggers who are going to bring it down to a landing and onto a truck, the truckers themselves who then drive it to point from point A to point B, the various transportation services that would get it across the water into Petersburg or further south if that's where it's headed, or overseas if that's where portions of it head. All of those jobs are part of that 183 annualized jobs.
Whether Tonka is worthwhile for potential bidders will depend on how the various harvest units are packaged together, according to Wrangell's George Woodbury. He's a board member of the timber group Alaska Forest Association. According to Woodbury, Tonka is not only important for bigger companies, but for the small operators as well.
It opens up areas where there's road where they can get roadside sales. Most of them can't afford to build road. And not only that, but the larger operations bring in infrastructure like towing companies and actually people that buy the products from the medium-sized mills when that attracts them into Southeast Alaska and gives the opportunity for the small guys that just have little bits to sell access to people that could buy their products.
The project is just across the Wrangell Narrows from Petersburg on Kuprnoff Island's Lindenberg Peninsula, one of the most accessible and important areas for local deer hunters. The sale area has already been extensively roaded and logged over the years. The loss of more habitat for deer and other wildlife is one of the major factors the agency has to consider in planning a timber sale.
It's extremely reckless for the Forest Service to continue removing deer habitat in this area.
Sitka fisherman and attorney Paul Olson is board president of the Greater Southeast Alaska Conservation Community, which includes members in Petersburg and Kuprnoff. Olson's group has raised extensive concerns about Tonka's impacts to fish and wildlife habitat and the locals who depend on it, particularly deer hunters. He says the Forest Service is high grading.
They're taking the best deer habitat out with this project, and they've already taken too much. And so they're really threatening the ability of the deer population to rebound from the severe winters of 2006 and 2007. And again, since this is an export-driven timber sale, they're basically making Petersburg hunters bear the burden of a timber sale that's where the economic benefits are going to be generated somewhere else.
Parties that commented on the draft Tonka Environmental Impact Statement have 45 days to appeal the Forest Service decision. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a remembrance for an unsolved murder in Fairbanks.
And following up on things that might have not been investigated fully, or taking new leads.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
The anniversary of a 1993 murder brought people together in Fairbanks yesterday to remember those lost in unsolved homicide cases. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
On April 26, 1993, 20-year-old Sophie Sergey was found shot to death in a University of Alaska Fairbanks dorm bathroom. Her killer has never been identified. Sergey's stepfather, Leslie Hunter Sr., says this time of year is especially tough for the family.
When the state comes close, we're always thinking of her and praying that one of these days somebody will come up with some kind of clue or something or to resolve it.
Attendees at the Fairbanks ceremony lit candles in Sophie Sergey's memory and for 32 other local victims of unsolved murders dating back to 1972. Tanana Chiefs Conference Justice Task Force Chair Shirley Lee says the event is to try to ease pain that never goes away.
We don't forget, and we are here to help justice be served.
Lee says the chance of resolving long cold cases is remote, but no one's giving up, citing Alaska State Troopers' renewed efforts in the Sergey case.
Last year in the Sophie Sergey case, the Alaska Bureau of Investigations reinvigorated their work into the case and have been going through the case extensively and following up on things that might have not been investigated fully or taking new leads. And so they're still doing their work, and we have hope that that will bring some result.
Unsolved homicides like the Sophie Sergey case also remain on the radar for local police. City of Fairbanks Deputy Chief Brad Johnson says the cases stay open.
Each of our cold cases is assigned to an investigator, and whenever any lead comes forward, then they pursue those leads and continue to investigate the case at every opportunity we have.
Officer Johnson says police know the pain of losing a loved one is worse when there are unresolved issues surrounding the death. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Residents of Port Hyden rescued a stranded sea otter pup last month and turned him over to the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. He was rehabilitated there for several weeks and now has found a permanent home at the Pittsburgh Zoo in Pennsylvania. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
In early March, some residents in Port Hyden found a sea otter pup on a windy beach by the frozen bay. He was the only apparent survivor of a group of sea otters that had beached themselves, having become trapped away from the open ocean. That little pup is now at the Pittsburgh Zoo and will be on view in his special nursery starting Friday. His journey from Port Hyden to Pittsburgh started in early March when he was about 3 weeks old. Brett Long is with the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, which was contacted by the residents.
This otter was found by the local community in Port Hyden. The bay in that area had frozen over, which had blocked access to open water to a group of otters. This pup was found with sort of an unknown number of otters, but was still alive, laying next to one that had already passed.
The Alaska Sea Life Center advised the residents on how to care for the pup overnight and quickly dispatched one of their veterinarians to King Salmon. The pup was flown the next day to King Salmon to meet the vet, then journeyed on to Seward, where he entered the rehabilitation program at ASLC.
Sea otter pups that have not been weaned from their mothers, if they are orphaned and picked up, they're deemed non-releasable. And so animals that the Sea Life Center responds to provide a triage and stabilize and provide short-term care for the animal until a suitable home can be identified somewhere on the lower 48 in this case.
The pup was named Meshik after the beach he was found on and was responding well to treatments, and by early April had been adopted by the Pittsburgh Zoo. It was just a question of getting him there. FedEx offered to arrange the transport. Dr. Barbara Baker is the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Zoo and explains.
So just imagine a sky kennel, you know, with this little otter in it, sitting on your lap. And so it doesn't look much different than it would be if you had a dog or a cat that you were bringing along on a trip. It just smells a little different.
Dr. Baker says the zoo is excited to have the pup and that they have the right facilities to give him a good home.
The sea otter right now is in a sea otter nursery. Once the animal's grown up a little bit here and he comes out of the nursery, then he'll be introduced to our two adult male otters. And we have three outdoor pools for our sea otters, so they're able to dive and do all of the natural behaviors that the sea otters do.
There were many helping hands in the journey to save this little fella, but Dr. Baker and Brett Long agree the lion's share of credit goes to the folks in Port Hyden.
And of course, the real heroes here are the folks in Port Hyden who recognized that this animal was in distress and that it needed help, and were able to rescue it very quickly because this little guy could have died on the ice.
He lost the name Meshik somewhere along the way and doesn't have a new one yet, but he has taken well to the treatments at the zoo's nursery, and they expect he might live up to 20 years. The public gets a first look at this adorable little celebrity when he goes on view starting Friday. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
If you were trying to get to Japonski Island near Sitka on Monday night, you probably found the bridge closed by police. It was part of a community-wide disaster drill. The exercise involved emergency responders, the Coast Guard, and even students from Mount Edgecombe High School. KCAW's Ed Ronco rode along and has the story.
The airport drill has started officially now, so this is a drill. Everybody head to the airport.
Sitka Fire Chief Dave Miller hops in his red SUV outside the Sitka Fire Hall and starts rolling toward the airport. He's towing the department's mass casualty trailer. In tonight's drill, a passenger jet has crashed during takeoff from Sitka's runway, which is surrounded by water.
Airport, can you give me an approximate of how many victims you think we have in the water and on land?
I'm assuming it's a 737-400, so we could have a crew of five and up to 140 passengers.
The official count ends up being 85 victims. About half of those are made up of foam and floating in the water around the airport. The other half are played by Mount Edgecombe High School students. They are lying all over a field between the airport's runway and taxiway. Miller pulls up on the scene.
If you can walk, move this way. If you're walking, move this way.
Some of them begin heading toward the fire trucks and ambulances. Others are on the ground, not moving. Students have been assigned roles, and some of them have been asked to play victims with serious, specific injuries. Firefighters are carrying people out on stretchers. EMTs are crouched around some students, while other pretend victims sit in the field, looking dazed and calling out for help.
Okay, I want you to just stay calm, take nice deep breaths, all right?
Okay.
The responders put color-coded tags on the mock victims. Green means the patient can walk. Yellow is someone who is injured and needs help to get around. Red is someone who needs immediate assistance. And a black tag means the victim has died. Terry Blake, a physician's assistant at Mount Edgecombe Hospital and, as it turns out, a member of the Sitka Assembly, is tending to one of the students who has been made up to look scarred and bloody.
I need a red high priority tag on this one.
Hey, can you hear me? Take a big breath for me.
Please. Open your eyes, Ron. Let me see you.
The student is loaded onto a stretcher and then carried to a red tarp, which matches his tag. There, he's tended to until an ambulance is available to take him to the hospital. Back at the fire hall, Chief Miller explains that handling a disaster here is a lot different than in larger communities.
If you watch on TV, the big disasters on TV, they'll have, you know, 100, 150 ambulances show up to start hauling patients. We have three.
So Miller says they just have to make do. And because Sitka is on an island, it can't call on other fire departments for assistance. But they certainly have help. The police, the state troopers, the Coast Guard, the Department of Transportation, Alaska Airlines, Sitka Community Hospital, Search, Allen Marine, and more all took part in the drill. At one point, Miller saw a bunch of fishing boats heading toward the runway and got on his radio to remind anyone listening that this was a drill. Fire Chief Miller says that if something actually happens, it will be very difficult for the community, and that he hopes his staff never, ever has to use what they've learned here today, but that he's glad they're ready. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon,
Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Alexander Gutierrez. This week on AK, Secrets of the Forest. Birch is one of the most common trees in Alaska, and they can easily blend into Alaska's forest landscape. But underneath the smooth, tough layer of a birch tree's bark, something is flowing. It's a natural treasure with many curative properties. KUAC's Emily Schwing met up with one very enthusiastic scientist to harvest the distinctive liquid.
On a cool, sunny evening, a group of about 12 people crunched through old snow in the woods, searching for the perfect birch tree.
So I think this might be this year's winner.
Kimberly Moore is a PhD candidate in natural resources at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She studies Alaska's birch, and as soon as you meet her, you can tell she loves her subjects.
Well, we don't have a lot of trees up here, and so there's not really a lot to choose from, but there's really something magical about the birch tree, and it's actually been celebrated in folklore all around the circumpolar north.
Mar teaches an annual workshop on how to tap the birch for their sap. She wants to find one that's just right for the harvest.
And so this might be a good tree to tap. It's good because you can see it's got a lot of light availability since it's sort of at the edge of the stand.
She carries a Z-shaped widget with a drill bit on one end and what looks like a doorknob on the other. She checks the tree for fungus and odd growths or old holes. Then she gets to work. She's tapping the tree. When the hole is finally drilled, Mar inserts a small black plastic tap or spile. The spile is connected to a rubber tube that spills into a plastic bucket on the ground. Now all we have to do is wait for the sap to start running. Mar says all it takes is a few good days of warm weather above 50 degrees. But birch trees, she says, are very responsive to changes in the weather.
I'm pretty sure it was spring 2002 where the sap season started going, and it was the first week of May, and then it just started snowing and we got like 3 days of snow. And so the trees had been pumping out some sap for a few days already. As soon as it got cold and started snowing, they shut down production and stopped for about 3 days.
During the winter, trees store the sap in their roots. It's chock full of minerals and nutrients the tree needs to produce its leaves come springtime.
A tree will produce anywhere from like half a gallon a day to some of my best producers produce like up to 5 gallons a day.
For rookie tapper Amy Tippery, it's all about the discovery.
The beauty of birch trees just astounds me at all seasons, but in the springtime when the sun's shining on them, I know there's got to be some treasures in there. And I really have this big curiosity to see the birch trees on my property start, well, I don't know if they're going to gush, but I'd really like to see what comes out. I think birch tapping is just so mysterious right now.
It's unclear how many people in Alaska tap birch trees for their sap, but Kimberly Marr says it's nothing new.
The sap has been harvested for thousands of years and in a bunch of different countries, and there's all different types of ailments that it's been used to treat.
Illnesses like tonsillitis and ailments like arthritis and hypertension. Birch sap isn't the sticky, gooey stuff you see oozing from other trees. It has the consistency of water. It's clear, and if you're Kimberly Marr, it sparkles ever so slightly. As for the taste,
it's kind of like licking a birch tree. No, I don't know how to describe it.
When Mar boils down the sap to make syrup, she says it's not the kind she pours over pancakes.
My favorite way to do it is over vanilla ice cream with some lingonberries, where you've got the tartness of the lingonberries and the creaminess of the ice cream and just like the papow of the birch syrup.
Birch sap flows from 10 days up to 2 weeks. Later in the season, tiny organisms will become active and the sap may turn a light pinkish. That's when Mar says the harvest is over.
Oh, you don't know me during the sap season. During the sap season, I walk around with a jug and I make everybody drink it. Like, I am a total sap pusher.
That's why she's always armed with a stack of Dixie cups this time of year, ready to offer a refreshing sip of her favorite sap to anyone who passes by. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're on our way to Wales, a Bering Sea community about 100 miles north of Nome.
My name is Frank Christie and I live in Wales and I am the mayor of Wales. You could almost call us isolated. We do not have any road system. We are not tied into a road system. The road system ends at Teller, which is just outside of Nome. It has about 2 stores. There's 3 entities here, the Wales Native Corp, the Native Village of Wales IRA, and of course the City of Wales. We have a Lutheran church, parsonage. That's about it, except for the school. There really isn't much here. There's no television. You've got radio. You can pick up the Nome station, sometimes Kotzebue.
The most going is whatever's held in Wales is bingo, any kind of social gatherings, and, town meetings. That's about it. We still have 10, 12-foot snow banks. Our mode of travel is snow machine. We haven't plowed out the roads yet. We have way too much snow. Yes, we are the only system, I guess, in the state of Alaska who are drinking uranium water. And that's to be filtered out as soon as the washateria is done and completed. That's why we want to see our washateria put together and, let's say, built to satisfy this uranium in our drinking water. It's natural. Yeah, we can't do anything about it. If we probably drilled another rig, would only cause another, let's say, well full of the same substance. Your chances are very good of running into the same thing. Wales is probably one of the villages out of maybe a few that have been left out of everything that we solely desire. And finally, we're getting what we've been wanting for so many years. It took 40 years to get a washateria.
Frank Christie is the mayor of Wales. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Schwing, Heather Arono, Annie White, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Alexandra Gutierrez was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Do you own a business or manage employees? Do you reassure employees with children that you're committed to supporting them? Well, research shows that employees who feel supported at work when handling their parenting challenges are more loyal and more productive. When you let employees know they can attend a parent-teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality childcare, you contribute to stronger families. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.